In the matter of Donna Rowe versus Bell and Gossett Company, may we please have appearances of counsel? Good afternoon, counsel, and welcome. Ms. Henry, please go ahead.
May it please the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'll have you back, perhaps for a little less, but please go ahead.
Thank you. I would like to cover three topics today that I think are crucial to this court's determination of this matter. The first is that both the plain language and the goals of the rules of evidence are satisfied by the introduction of proofs allowed by the trial court in this case. The second is that the goals of the Comparative Negligence Act and the Joint Tortfeasor Contribution Law are advanced by the admission of this evidence. And the third is that, respectfully, the Appellate Division's opinion is supported by a fundamental misunderstanding of how the practice of mass torts are conducted in Middlesex County. The issue before this court today is the trial court's decision to admit historically developed, previously relied on, vetted and inherently reliable proofs in advance of a cross-claims case by Universal Supply. I'd like to start out by emphasizing that I'm not asking this court, and we did not ask the trial court, to sacrifice justice towards the goals of efficiency. I believe that the trial court's well-reasoned decisions with regard to the admission of evidence satisfy the goals of both justice and efficiency. Plaintiffs are asking this honorable court to establish a rule that would torture numerous hearsay exceptions to try to keep out the proofs that have been relied on for years. They are advancing that prospect so that they may settle a case against numerous defendants and then collect their entire judgment as against one or two remaining defendants. I don't blame them for making this argument. It is their job to do so. However, the system they wish to set up is one in which they can sue between 30 and 80 defendants. They can settle with many of those defendants prior to trial, and then they can cut off strategically sources of proof right before or on the eve of trial, and then collect their entire verdict against one or two remaining defendants. I submit that this does not satisfy the goals of justice or efficiency. We're not asking for an exception to the evidence rules. We're not asking this court to ignore the evidence rules. Plaintiffs are asking this court to endorse an evidentiary scheme where proofs are admissible when offered by them, but then inadmissible when it's our burden of proof to offer them against a settled defendant. In their appellate brief, they freely admitted that the exact proofs they're seeking to preclude us from using here are the exact types of proofs. I don't know that they would have used the same sets, but the exact types of proofs they would have sought to have been admitted had these defendants not settled prior to trial. There is no reason to believe that the trial court abused its discretion here. The trial court heard extensive arguments and made detailed rulings with regard to these proofs. Your Honors, those arguments went on over 200 pages of trial transcript. There was a reasoned decision for what proofs were let in and what proofs were excluded. Universal, my client, offered just over 30 sets of interrogatory answers and deposition transcript excerpts. The court allowed in 17 and excluded the rest based upon findings of that they were speculative, confusing, not relevant, or potentially inflammatory. And I'll give you just one example. We tried to introduce some proofs against a settled boiler defendant. Plaintiff made some objections, and their objections were essentially, wait, that's not the same time period at issue here, or that's not the same type of boiler. It was a residential boiler, not a commercial boiler. And the trial court listened to all those objections and let in proofs that she thought matched the evidence introduced by the plaintiff in this case and kept out proofs that had less to do with the facts of this case. Evidentiary rulings are reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. Plaintiffs have been unable to articulate any reason why the trial judge abused her discretion in this case. I'm going to briefly talk about two hearsay exceptions I think directly apply, and the reason I'm talking about these two is they don't require unavailability. There was some discussion in the appellate division as to whether the corporate representatives of the co-defendants were unavailable. I submit to you that these aren't witnesses that I can just go out and subpoena. They're represented by counsel. I sent notices in lieu of subpoena. We sent notices in lieu of subpoena. We followed up, and officers of the court, their attorneys, told us they were unavailable. But to sort of get away from that whole argument, I'd like to focus on two hearsay exceptions that don't require unavailability. One is the statement of a party opponent, which is 803B1 and B2. And the other one is the statement of interest, against interest, I'm sorry, which is 803B25. I think it's important for this court to also note that 803B25, the statement against interest, does not require the statement to be given by a party. So again, by focusing on this exception, we don't have to go through whether a settled co-defendant remains a party after settlement or doesn't remain a party.
Counsel, can I stop you for a minute?
Sure.
These witnesses, they were corporate designees?
That's right, Your Honor.
They were all out of state, right?
The two that were, well, all the actual designees were out of state, but
right.
Two corporations.
Does Rule 191 allow you to subpoena individuals that do not reside within the state of New Jersey to come to trial in New Jersey?
Individuals or?
Or corporate designees.
Does it allow us to subpoena out-of-state witnesses?
Does New Jersey have jurisdiction to bring in out-of-state residents?
Does not,
okay.
Your Honor.
Does that make them unavailable by definition because you can't bring them in?
It does, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's one of the ways.
Now, you talk about the hearsay. Don't the rules of court, Rule 461, use the depositions apply here even more so than the rules of evidence? Depositions can be used by any 416.1C, I submit to you. Says that depositions can be used by any party against any party, even if not the same party's in the litigation, so unless it was someone was there with a similar interest.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that allow the depositions to be read in? And interrogatories in the 417 rely on 416.1, so where they didn't forget the rules of evidence, which you're making your arguments on.
Yep.
Don't the rules of court, which control the use of depositions at trial and subpoenaing witnesses at trial, make these witnesses unavailable and allow the use of their depositions simply without getting into a hearsay analysis?
They do, Your Honor, and that's what the trial judge did in this case. That's what she focused on. That's how these proofs came in. Because of the rulings and the arguments made in the appellate division, I decided to shift and tell you why I thought there was other reasons that they get in, but that's the exact analysis done by the trial judge that you'll see in that trial transcript.
So let's talk about a notice in lieu of subpoena. Assuming the party hasn't been dismissed, you've served it. You served notice in lieu of subpoenas
that's
on
right.
All the parties. And you said that the notices would continue to remain in effect even if you've settled,
we
correct?
We did, Your Honor. Yes.
When a party does not abide by a notice, can you seek enforcement through the court?
We can. We did not seek enforcement through the court based upon the representations of their counsel, officers of the court. They said their people were physically located out of state and physically unable to come to New Jersey for the trial.
So let's start. I'm trying to understand this.
Okay.
Hopefully this will be informative to me. Before they're dismissed and they're a party, and so the court has jurisdiction over the corporation, and one of the corporate representatives is residing out of state, is it your position that the court does not have the ability to order the defendant, the party before it, to have its corporate representative appear before the court?
So I don't know that I'd go that far, Your Honor. The court may well have the right to have a corporate representative appear before the court.
Even though the person is so-called unavailable outside of the state.
So that's where we have the difference between the corporation and the corporate representative. The issues we're talking about here go back some 50 to 60 years. There are a small subset of people that are still alive that work for these corporations with knowledge about the issues we were at trial for. So the trial judge may well be able to force a corporation to bring in a corporate representative. I do not believe the trial judge could force them to educate a corporate representative about sale and exposure to asbestos products in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, review the documents.
No, I'm only talking about now the ability to bring the corporate representative in the state when the court has jurisdiction over the party.
I think the trial judge could force a corporate representative to come to the courtroom.
So my question to you then is, since you put on your notice in lieu of subpoena, that it remains in effect even if you party, you've settled, why you didn't go before the court and say, give me a little help, and order that corporation to present this witness?
Because counsel for those corporations represented to me that the person with knowledge of the issues in this case was actually unavailable. Some of those representatives whose transcripts we read in are deceased.
Dead is unavailable.
For sure.
Okay. Assume alive and still within the employ of the corporation.
I don't know if I can assume alive and still within the employ of the corporation, because I don't think that that's true. But they're certainly alive. But let's say alive and within the employ of the corporation, just for purposes of argument. Mm-hmm. These people settled their case, bought their piece, and are faced with hundreds, if not thousands, of asbestos cases nationwide.
So I get that.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to really grapple with and understand is the power of the court, because you suggested that the court while the defendant is a party before the court. The court has the authority to order them to bring a corporate representative from out of state within. So what I'm trying to understand is when they've settled while the case is ongoing with a remaining defendant, does the court retain that same jurisdictional power in the interest of justice?
I think they have. I think they have retained that same jurisdictional power. But I think that power is to bring in a corporate representative.
Let me see if I understand the point you're making. You're dealing with historic events, and often companies that are sued in lots of litigation will essentially have a relationship with a retiree who might have knowledge of the past events, because those are the events that people continue to serve notices for depositions of, and they would present them as corporate representatives. When the company is currently in the case. Is that generally what we're talking about
that's
here?
That's correct.
Okay. But those individuals are coming to court at the behest of their former employer. They are not coming to court because they have been subpoenaed and as individuals have an obligation to show up.
That's correct.
Is that the distinction that you're talking about?
It is, Your Honor, and I also think it's important to note that when they're coming at the behest of their employer or independent contractor, however mm-hmm. they work it, the employer is working to get them familiar with the facts of the case such that they can give educated testimony.
Right. These are corporate designees.
Corporate designee.
Yeah.
I can't compel that.
Yes.
What I can do is I can read in a transcript of somebody that was prepared to testify about this boiler or this gasket or this pump.
And that's how you begin your testimony. You're politely telling us, don't worry about availability, because I've got a basis to introduce this without the court concerning itself on that issue. Is that where you were headed?
That's correct.
So why don't you start with statement against interest?
Okay. So I think the statement against interest is the clearest way this evidence gets in. Frankly, the trial court disagreed with me, which is why you won't see a lot of discussion about that at the trial court level. I think the appellate division got sidetracked by reading one part of the statement against interest and not the other part. But frankly, I think this falls under both. So in order to be a statement against interest, the statement has to be contrary to the declarant's pecuniary, proprietary, or social interest. I think this falls within that, and I'll tell you why. The second prong is, or so far tended to subject the declarant to civil liability. And that's the section that the appellate division focused on. And what the appellate division said, essentially, is that because the statements don't establish a prima facie case, they do not tend to subject the declarant to liability. I don't think that's the rule. The statements of the corporations that we read in satisfied a couple prongs of the prima facie case. What we were trying to get in through those statements is, one, we manufactured or sold asbestos products. Two, we sold them without warnings. So that's two prongs of the prima facie case. We used plaintiff's own testimony and plaintiff's medical causation expert testimony to give us three and four, which is I was exposed and the exposure was sufficient to cause disease. Nowhere in this rule or the case law evaluating this rule says To be against interest, the statement has to cover every aspect of the prima facie case and essentially prove the case against, or prove a case against the
statement. In fact, in a case like you're talking about here, that would just almost be inconceivable because that has medical causation as part of the element, as well as the person would have to be totally knowledgeable about absolutely everything involving asbestos, right?
That's exactly correct. Can you imagine a defendant corporation saying, we sold asbestos without warnings, it caused plaintiff or people in his position to be exposed, and it caused them to be exposed sufficiently to meet the New Jersey medical causation standard. We're never going to have that. So we prove some through the corporate representative prior testimony, and some through the plaintiff's own testimony.
So can I ask you to clarify something?
Sure.
And then a question? There were excerpts of the interrogatories and depositions read to the jury, of course. Were there other documents, the actual portions of the deps and interrogatories that were introduced but not read, or is the sum total of the information we are to be concerned about that which was read?
The sum total is that which was read. No documents were sent back with the jury on these issues.
Okay. So I happen to have in front of me the transcript for the portion with regard to Honeywell, defendant Honeywell. And it has some number of paragraphs that talk about corporate ownership and when this company merged with that and this name changed with that and so on. That doesn't come in understatement against interest.
One of, I guess it does for successor liability.
Yeah,
so one of the jobs the trial court gave to us with regard to our burden of proof to prove the case against the settled defendants is to prove that the defendant as named has liability for the defendant as looked on a product and saw their name on a product.
Which is what plaintiff would have to do if they had not settled.
So those were foundational proofs to prove that today's Honeywell is the same as whatever that product that had the word Honeywell on it that the plaintiff was exposed to back in the day. So it,
you know what I was wondering?
Sure.
If these so-called declarations against interest are declarations against interest, why do we have so much asbestos litigation? Like, why aren't they all folding?
Isn't
it so clear?
I think that goes to, I mean, the appellate division called some things unrebuttable and irrefutable. And I think, frankly, some things at this point in the litigation are unrebuttable and irrefutable. Not because plaintiff can't refute them, but because factually, if a corporation has admitted a bad fact for them time and time again, I don't know how factually you could possibly rebut it. And the rest of the answer to that question I'm not going to say on the record, Your Honor. So the one prong is so far tended to subject the declarant to civil liability. And the other one is against pecuniary interest. Well, to focus on what you just said, Your Honor, given the breadth, scope, expense of the nationwide asbestos litigation, what could a company say besides, I sold a product with asbestos in it, and I sold it without warning, that would be more against their interest than that statement? I suggest to you that if we're talking about a company saying something that's against their pecuniary interest, that's it, Your Honor.
That raises an interesting issue. I don't know that it's really dealt with in the briefing, but is it when if an individual was a corporate designee, is the declarant the individual, or is the declarant the corporation?
So we dealt with that at the trial court level, and we were unable to introduce deposition proofs where the employee of the corporation was not designated as the corporate designee. So if I don't remember if it was Honeywell, so don't quote me on that, but if we had Honeywell proofs, if the person was designated as a corporate designee, we were allowed to read that in. If they were just a witness that worked at Honeywell, we weren't. So
do you think that is a fair distinction for this kind of setting?
I think it is. I think if we're talking about an admission that ABC company made, it can't be something that just one of their employees said. If it's going to be a statement against interest, it has to be something that the corporation adopted by virtue of the corporate designee.
Is there a need, as you read the rules, for an order similar to what the New York courts have done?
I've read the New York order, and I think it does a great job of getting us there.
Please go ahead.
However, we don't have an order, and that's what we've been doing anyway. before this appeal and before the appellate division's ruling.
So that's my question. Is there a gap that needs to be filled?
I think there is, because I think the court needs to answer this question in a way that's adverse to the way the appellate division answered this question. The way the appellate division answered this question is that I have to bring in a live witness or prove actual unavailability. I'm not sure if it's that witness or of the corporation. Frankly, I don't know that the opinion talks about this in each and every case. In Middlesex County, there's 470 cases pending. In those cases, the average is 30 to 80 defendants. Sometimes 5 defendants are sued, sometimes 200 defendants are sued. So, I mean, half of this analysis is what do the rules of evidence require, and I think we've satisfied that, but the other half of this analysis is the why. Why do we need to reinvent the wheel time and time again? The proofs that we introduced in this case were the proofs that were on plaintiffs' pretrial designations. There is no issue of surprise. There is no issue that they weren't aware of these proofs. They're the exact same proofs that we've been offering back and forth against each other. I mean, some of them they actually used to oppose the defendant's motions for summary judgment. They said, this is the prima facie evidence. This is what we'll use at trial. This is why you belong in this case.
And the law on allocation under these cases, since Young versus Lotta, is the key focus is everybody on notice? And early enough in the case that discovery can be taken and people are not essentially surprised by the result that they're suddenly in a different position than they were pre-settlement. And it seems like everyone in the litigation you're involved with seems to understand that this is a real prospect and people are proceeding accordingly. Everybody understands this can happen.
Everybody in New Jersey that practices in the asbestos litigation knows that the settled defendant will try to apportion liability to the remaining defendants. This case started trial right after the first trial that the trial judge did in New Brunswick, which was the Condon case, that had the same plaintiff's counsel, not our client, but some of the same cast of characters, and the exact same procedure was gone through. There is no surprise. I don't know how many sets of proofs our list had, but plaintiff's own set of proofs had 1,490 sets of proofs. We pulled from those proofs to put on our trial evidence. I mean, these are proofs that have been around 10, 20, 30 years. They've been taken by established, smart, good attorneys that fought on both sides of these cases. One of the things that the trial judge did was made sure that people were in the same position when these proofs were taken, right?
So, but their argument is it makes all the difference who's it being admitted against. So before, like, Young versus Lotta, and assuming we didn't have apportionment, then you'd bring in the settled person. And as you're introducing the evidence, and this is what your adversary is arguing, they'd be pushing back. And it's the not pushing back is what your adversaries are talking is the great harm here. How do you respond to that?
Plaintiff gets to push back. Plaintiff gets to push back in the context of counter designations. They can read in anything that sort of goes with what I read, and they get to push back in the context of a rebuttal case.
And they can take the settling defendant's statements in their own defense, which may be very vigorously denying the allegations of the plaintiffs at that time, and use those statements which were made against them in their favor post-settlement, correct?
Absolutely. And to the extent folks are unavailable, they can call them in their rebuttal cases. If I put something on in my case in chief that's not adverse to what plaintiff's case was, which is exactly what this is, because it's against our co-defendants or our settled defendants, they can call any live witness that is available in their rebuttal case.
Non-live, because you're even conceding the doctrine of completeness. And plus we have also an evidence rule that when one side brings in hearsay, the other side can bring in hearsay to rebut the hearsay, right?
That's right, and some of that was done in this trial. When we made designations, they made counter-designations, and as long as it was, you know, on the same subject, the same type of evidence hitting the same points, it was by and large let in. But this whole concept that the proofs aren't let in against the settled defendants, I don't accept that. The burden of proof as to the settled defendants switches to me the minute plaintiff settles the case. I have to put on the exact same prima facie proofs that plaintiff would have had to put on had they not settled. This evidence is coming in against the settled defendants. Now, plaintiff has chosen voluntarily to take settlement money as opposed to a verdict. But they can't sort of magically change the character of these proofs. The whole purpose of these proofs is to make a prima facie case against the settled defendant. And I understand that the settled defendant isn't there. But in addition to what I think are independent indicia of reliability, time, number of attorneys, the amount of times we've beat this dead horse with regard to these same companies, plaintiffs gets to step in those shoes. Plaintiffs' counsel files thousands of asbestos suits across the country. I guarantee you, if I read something in that's inconsistent with something else out there that is helpful to their case, they're going to be there to read it in.
This process can help a plaintiff as to you, as to your liability, because you are in the position of saying that if the products are there and there are no warnings, that's essentially, and plus the causation and damages elements, that's the case. So this is not without risk for a defense lawyer who is seeking apportionment, correct?
It's absolutely a tough place to be. And the reason plaintiff didn't rebut is their theory of the case didn't allow them to rebut, not for any evidentiary reasons. Plaintiff's theory of the case is every exposure to asbestos, regardless of fiber type, regardless of dose, causes disease. So how does plaintiff rebut a proof that the plaintiff worked with an asbestos break 15 times? You know, I don't think he can rebut the fact that the break contained asbestos. I mean, if that's what the proof is out there, that's what the proof is. But you have to rebut sort of the exposure case, the dust case, the friability case. How was plaintiff exposed to that? They can't do that in these cases because they have an expert that gets up and says every exposure to every asbestos fiber that's occupational exposure causes disease. So the rules of evidence didn't prevent plaintiff from rebutting. Plaintiff's theory of the case prevented them from rebutting. Hit a lot of the issues already. I just want to point to
not
two.
A bad thing.
I just want to point to two quick issues I saw with the appellate division's opinion. And when I read the appellate division's opinion, I felt that they had felt that there was some kind of injustice. And those are the two issues I want to speak to. One is they say, and I quote, plaintiff quote stood to lose a significant portion of the jury's quantum of damages. Well, that's not the analysis. Plaintiff didn't lose any of the jury's quantum of damages. Plaintiff voluntarily settled away their right to collect those damages. Plaintiff is in the best position to determine how much settlement money to take from various defendants and who to try the case against and who not to try the case against. They didn't lose anything. They accepted that money in settlement versus in a verdict.
In fact, I don't know to what extent you're familiar with other states, but in other states there may be that don't have exactly our system, there might be a dollar-for-dollar credit for the settlement right off the top. So this is not, it's not as if other states simply don't have apportionment. It can be a very severe limitation on plaintiff's recovery dollar-for-dollar.
The trial courts mold the verdicts, and plaintiffs end up with zero, depending on different states' laws. The other thing I saw that I had pause with is this idea of plaintiff being left with little recourse. That's some of the wording. Universal could maximize the impact of that evidence while leaving plaintiff little recourse. They later used the words, transform statements of settling defendants into unrebuttable admissions, and later they call them irrefutable admissions. Plaintiffs have the world of proofs that we have to rebut or refute anything we put on. You know, this. In your standard one-off products liability case, if I brought in, you know, Joe Blow, corporate representative from Montana, and used that to prove my case, plaintiff wouldn't know where that came from, what context that was taken in, whether any other representative of that corporation had testified adversely in the past. That's not where we are. Plaintiffs have a library of proofs that they can use to rebut presumptions.
Can I come back to the New York order for just a second?
Sure.
Before we wrap up your argument, assume the court issues an opinion in this case that addresses the outstanding questions. You prevail in part or in full, or your adversary the same. Is there a need then for a separate order similar to the New York order? One way or the other. I'm not forecasting the merits here, but is there a need for anything beyond a statement of principles that a court's opinion could provide?
I think guided by this court's opinion, I think the presiding judge, the trial judge in Middlesex County, would do a great job crafting an order that links to what the opinion is that's developed in this case.
Understood. Anything else you'd like to present now?
Just briefly, and I mean really briefly. In the appellate division paperwork, the plaintiffs say Mr. Rowe, quote, may well have been undercompensated. I think it's instructive that even plaintiff's attorney won't say he was undercompensated. We know that the verdict was $1.5 million, so that's what the jury believes Mr. Rowe should have got for his asbestos-related injury. Plaintiffs have been unwilling to disclose a sum that's less than $1.5 million that includes settlement money and verdict money. Neither the Comparative Negligence Act nor the Joint Tortfeasor Law was established to allow plaintiffs to recover a windfall. I submit that that's what the appellate division's order does, and that's why I would ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Mr. Gaffrey, excuse me.
Thank you. May it please the court. As I indicated at the outset, I'm here on behalf of the New Jersey Defense Association, which is an association on behalf of the defense professionals and defense bar in the state. And while we weren't present at the trial, we certainly join in all of the arguments that counsel made, and we'll rely primarily upon our briefs here. I just have a couple of statements to make on behalf of the New Jersey Defense Association, and that is, first of all, there are multiple defendant cases outside of this typical case that counsel just alluded to that she tried in the Roe case. There are many multiple defendant cases where a corporate representative of a settled defendant may not be present, may have been deceased, and we just want the court to be aware that any decision made in this case certainly may have an impact on other multiple defendant cases. And secondly, the New Jersey Defense Association really urges the court to really put forth a decision that gives a roadmap to other type cases that are similar to this, whether it be toxic tort or other multiple defendant cases, so that we have a better understanding of how we are to proceed at trial, how we are to present our proofs against settled defendants, and as Your Honor had indicated, perhaps a crafted order by the presiding asbestos judge could set the standard for asbestos litigation, other toxic tort litigation. And
can I have a question for you, if I may,
yes,
about,
yes,
you know, obviously Young versus Lotta was critical because it said not only said what it said in terms of apportionment, but it also said that a cross-claim is not critical. And in the apportionment law, generally, the case law, cross-claims are not the linchpin of the ability to seek apportionment. The evidentiary practice in the asbestos cases, based on this record, seems to assume that cross-claims will be filed among defendants. And I don't know if that's the history of the asbestos cases or whatever it may be, but do you see at all a possible disconnect between the apportionment law that doesn't rely on cross-claims and the evidentiary foundation, including the court, by that I also mean the court rules Justice Fernandez-Vina alluded to, that does seem to rely in part on the existence of a cross-claim.
Right, and just for purposes of asbestos litigation, each and every defendant that's named in an asbestos case files a general answer at the beginning when they're first named in their very first asbestos case. And I know on behalf of my client, and I represent many defendants in asbestos litigation, our standard answer, which we adopt in every subsequent case thereafter, contains a general cross-claim against each and every defendant.
For contribution and common law indemnification, I assume?
Correct.
Okay.
And in fact, it's presumed that we're going to assert those cross-claims, whether they be non-settled defendants that are at counsel table with us at trial, or they be settled defendants for purposes of apportionment. And Your Honor had indicated that other states have a pro tanto arrangement, mm-hmm. which is a dollar-for-dollar set-off, as opposed to pro rata, or they have a choice, whichever benefits the defendant more. But it's the proofs that follow with the apportionment. The cross-claims is the mechanism by which to assert the ability to apportion, but it's the proofs that are key.
Right, but for example, in medical malpractice cases, and I don't know, is it the practice for defendants raised in them, in those cases, to cross-claim? At times they have not.
Yeah,
so what I'm getting at is there may be areas in which cross claims are simply not asserted. Areas of law. Are we back to essentially where we were before Young versus Lotta, where cross claims really are essential?
Well, I think cross claims are essential, and for a predominant purpose, and that is to put plaintiff on notice of what we intend to assert. And I don't practice in the field of medical malpractice, but I would presume that cross claims are asserted in certain circumstances where there is a purpose for those cross claims, and in other circumstances where perhaps there's a relationship, maybe there's an indemnification issue that the company has already agreed to assume indemnification. I don't know. But the actual cross-claim practice of pleading cross-claims is essential to put plaintiffs on notice, and then discovery could correspond accordingly.
But our law of apportionment, once there's settlement, our law of apportionment basically nullifies the need for the cross-claims, correct?
Well,
I mean, if we didn't have apportionment, then the cross claims would live on. They would have import, correct?
Right, and in fact, it was a case, I don't have the site in front of me, Teff versus Teff, which entitles a defendant to resolve a case and then be able to walk away from the case having received a settlement by plaintiff, whereby plaintiff has agreed to indemnify the defendant at trial, and that indemnification is by way of permitting apportionment.
Okay. Well, that would be a different situation. Did the settlements have that type of indemnification provision in this case, do you know?
When I settle a case, I always put that language so I can walk away from the case and have plaintiff's counsel, who I've settled with, indemnify me for any of the cross-claims. So I'm monetarily, I'm not on the hook for any.
And that's where the apportionment comes into play, because it assures there won't be any need for indemnification. Everyone will be discredited based upon the allocation.
Correct.
Anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Caffrey. Ms. Long.
Thank you, Your Honors. The plaintiffs here do not seek to destroy a defendant's right to apportionment. Rather, when the defendant seeks that apportionment, we only want the rules of evidence to apply in an equal and fair manner, the same way that they would apply to the evidence that we bring against a trial defendant. There was a lot of discussion about the unfairness here and that plaintiffs may obtain a windfall by settling with certain defendants and then going to trial against another, but there is no windfall, there is no fairness when our claims against defendants are proved by the adversarial process, where evidence is tested and hearsay is not allowed unless it fits an exception, and the defendants are allowed to prove apportionment without being constricted by the rules of evidence. That does not result in a fair result. The statements that the defendants sought to admit through interrogatory responses and depositions of the corporations were offered against the plaintiff. And that determination by the appellate division was critical to their determination that the evidence was inadmissible under rules 803B1 and 416-1B, as well as the corollary of 417-8A. And the appellate division set forth several reasons why, as a matter of practicality, these proofs were actually offered against the plaintiff. And that's where the court discussed that plaintiff would have no recourse to challenge these proofs, that the only practical import of these proofs or of any jury determination about apportionment was on the plaintiff, that it would be the plaintiff that would lose damages. The settled defendants would not be affected at all by the apportionment that the jury comes up with. The defendant has no right to seek future more money from the settled defendants, regardless of what they prove on apportionment. And the cases that discuss apportionment, particularly Young v. Lotta and Vernie X. Rel. Bernstein v. Harry M. Stevens, Inc., when these cases talk about apportionment and when it's available to a defendant, they show that they support the argument that this evidence is actually offered against the plaintiff. For example, in Young v. Lotta, where it was found that you could have apportionment even without cross-claims, that goes to show that the idea that it's the cross-claims surviving the settlement, and that's why this evidence is offered against the settled defendants, is not true under the law. Because Young v. Lotta said that the settling tortfeasor shall have no further liability to any party, and it noted that the only reason for submitting to the finder of fact the question of settling defendant's liability is to provide a basis for calculating the credit to which the non-settler is entitled. In Vernie X. Rel. Bernstein, when the court held that the plaintiff could not move for summary judgment and extinguish the right to apportionment, the court noted that even if the non-settler has cross-claimed for contribution, that claim is dismissed as a matter of law, and that by virtue of the settlements, all claims against the settled defendants, including contribution, has been dismissed as a matter of law. So both the plain language of these holdings that says there's no longer a claim by the trial defendants against the settled defendants, and the broad approach to apportionment, the fact that apportionment is allowed when there's a John Doe defendant, when the defendant has never asserted a cross claim against the settled defendant, shows that this evidence is not in fact offered against the settled defendant. Why it's so important that the settled that under these hearsay exceptions that the deposition actually be offered against the declarant who made the statement is that underlying these rules of evidence is the idea that hearsay is disfavored, and the reason we make an exception for statements of parties that are offered against them at trial is they are there to address those statements, to explain them, to put them in context, and being the declarant themselves, they cannot complain of not having a fair opportunity to challenge the evidence.
Ms. Long, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
About a different rule?
Of course.
Statement against interest.
Sure.
We have here evidence that's introduced in which companies admit that they produced and or sold products that contained asbestos during particular periods of time without issuing any warnings. To keep it simple, why is that not a statement against interest?
It's not a statement against interest because there is much more required to hold a defendant liable for someone's injury. The appellate division noted in Hughes versus A.W. Chesterton that the mere absence of a warning on an asbestos-containing product does not render the product defective.
So your position is that all elements must be incorporated in the statement. The all elements of your burden of proof, if you were proving the case against that defendant, or the non-settling defendant's burden of proof, must be in the statement. The statement must cover all bases for the other side.
I don't know that every single element, and particularly the court has talked about medical causation, I don't know that every single element of the claim needs to be in them for them to be a statement against interest.
What if it proves an element of your burden or the non-settling defendant's burden?
Well,
why is that not a statement which was at that time so far contrary, et cetera, under the language of the rule?
Well, and I think each statement would have to be looked at to see what the import was, because here the defendants are arguing for a rule that says any of these statements, no matter whether it's a party
I don't think we're hearing that from them. Let me just be clear. You're saying that what's missing is if not all elements are essentially proven, if the statement is not the entire ballgame as to that settling defendant's theoretical liability, the statement is not a statement against interest.
Again, I think that I could envision circumstances where there are answers that fall short of every element that might be a statement against interest, but the character of the statements that was let in here, which is simply our product contained asbestos and it didn't contain a warning, those do not rise to the level of a statement against interest.
Suppose somebody, your predecessor, decades ago, had come across a document that contained exactly that, Don't you think you'd be able to fashion a very powerful argument about how damaging this evidence is and contrary to your colleague's interest?
Well, sure. I mean, obviously, evidence, part of the evidence against a defendant is that the product contained asbestos and that it lacked a warning. But there are often other parts of that that you need to get even those full elements. For example, a defendant may say that their product contained asbestos, and some of the answers discussed in this case, the defendant would say, our product may have contained asbestos. Certain boilers contained asbestos at certain times. Mm-hmm. And then if that defendant is actually defending itself in a case, it would explain that not all of their models of boilers contained asbestos. And
so your point is that certainly these kinds of statements could be yet more damning. But how does that undermine the fact that they're statements of interest in the way that they are crafted here?
Because the statements can be made without subjecting them, the defendants, to civil liability, and the statements are not necessarily so far against their interest that they wouldn't have been made if they weren't true. Because they can put certain information into the statement, into their interrogatory responses, and clarify them with further information. And certainly, if, as Your Honor noted, if this was enough, if interrogatory responses that say we sold asbestos and we didn't put a warning on until such and such date was enough to subject these defendants to liability, was so far against their interest, there wouldn't be asbestos litigation.
But weren't they barred, those type of statements, by the trial judge? In other words, and why, if someone said, yeah, we made some boilers that had asbestos but not all, why wouldn't you be able to say, well, there's no evidence, they haven't shown in this case that it was the boilers we were involved with, therefore it's irrelevant, it's speculative, and it shouldn't be allowed, and the judge would have barred it. What prevents you from saying they haven't shown that the asbestos was in these particular boilers that are in our case? It seems to me that would be a fairly easy argument to make. They made some boilers that had it, we didn't say they made it, they put it in this boiler, should be out. And the judge seemed to, from what I read, seemed to barred those kind of statements. Anything that was speculative, anything that was irrelevant. So, well, how are you harmed because their proofs fail? It happens in many cases. You say, judge, that's not allowed. It's 403. You know,
sure,
unduly prejudicial.
There are other, once the interrogatories were ruled admissible, and again, the trial court didn't rule them admissible under 803C25. She declined to exercise her jurisdiction and enforce that rule. And there are other challenges that can be made to the interrogatories. And I do note that the trial judge here, I think in their papers, Universal said she spent 4 days ruling on the different interrogatory responses and that there were 200 pages of transcript devoted to that, which I think cuts very much into the efficiency rule that somehow bringing live testimony is easier than going through 4 days worth of interrogatory responses on other types of challenges. But the rule that the defendants envision would allow any negative statement by a non-party, whether or not they're available, to come in under this hearsay exception.
Isn't that what Rule 403 comes in for your objection? Say, Your Honor, I'd likely to confuse the jury, undue waste of time, unduly prejudicial, and then the judge would have a 401 hearing and determine what is and what isn't. Isn't that what 403 is designed for?
Well, 403 is designed to address otherwise admissible evidence, and our argument is that...
Well, if it's irrelevant, it's even easier, isn't it? Completely irrelevant. That seems like a pretty easy argument to make. Rule 403 is designed to protect against relevant evidence that may be inadmissible because it's unduly prejudicial, et cetera. If it's completely irrelevant and you can show that, you don't even need to go there. I don't see how you're prejudiced. They bring something up, you argue that it's irrelevant, judge rules on it, and you move on.
Sure. As I say, there are other ways to challenge the evidence, but I don't think we even need to get there because this hearsay exception just isn't applicable to these statements.
So let's talk, you mentioned party. And so the comparative negligence statute, tell me if I'm mistaken, requires that the act be used with parties.
Correct.
Okay. In Young and in Grinnell, we went through a little bit of a fiction. in order to have this allocation apportionment, we said you're still a party, correct? For purposes of the apportionment, you're a party.
Sure. I think we did that
in order to have it fit within the comparative negligence scheme. Am I right about that?
I mean, I think it's unclear whether, for example, Kreslowski v. Tyndall says that apportionment doesn't depend on party status. And I think that's to some degree a recognition that if they are called parties, it's only for the purposes of making it clear that there's an apportionment credit.
So why, right. And I think in Grinnell we actually said that, you're a party for these purposes. So I suppose your adversaries are saying, well, if you're a party for the allocation, why aren't you still a party? We've engaged in this one fiction. We'll continue this fiction in order for the sound administration and efficiency of justice. And if they get in some hearsay, then you can get in as much hearsay as you want.
Well, so. I think the legal fiction that's important for apportionment, that there be an avenue for the defendants to get the credit that they would get now that we have a contribution scheme, does not correlate to then how we enforce the evidentiary rules. And with the evidentiary rules, as I said, the underlying justification for allowing someone to admit prior statements of a party is that that party is there at court, able to address those statements.
Can we agree that...
Here we won't have that.
Can we agree that if there are cross claims for indemnification and contribution, even though there's a settlement, there's still parties as to those cross claims. The cross claims haven't been extinguished, and we engage in a fiction. They don't have to come to court, but there's still parties so that the jury can assess their percentage of negligence, even though they're settling defendants. Can we agree that as long as there are viable cross claims and they haven't been dismissed, they're still parties?
I would not say for the purposes of evidence that there are still parties in that way. And again,
wouldn't it be futile to have a cross claim for contribution and indemnification if you can't provide evidence as to the settling party? That would be found 0% negligence. There would be no contribution.
Sure.
So you have to have evidence as to those parties, even though they've settled. Well, that's the way it works.
They do have their ability to bring evidence. It's just that they have to bring the evidence in a way that meets the hearsay rules. And, for example, by bringing a live corporate representative witness.
You see what you're saying, though? You're saying that in a case of 80 defendants, each defendant that envisions that it might be a non-settling defendant at trial has to take the Bene Esse depositions of corporate representatives at a time when that party is still in for purposes of a future allocation. So if you multiply 80 defendants times 79 potential settling defendants that each one of them has to worry about, because it can happen in all different directions, you're talking about a huge waste of dollars if you're going to require those depositions to be taken at a time when the courts can still compel attendance.
Sure. So I think there's a couple of ways to address that. First of all, as a practical matter, if you look at the way this case played out, I think it started with somewhere above 20 defendants. A certain amount got out through summary judgment, and then the settlements were made sort of between that summary judgment phase and the trial phase. The defendants won't be required to take additional discovery in order to present a witness at trial, because they have the option of calling the witness live.
Let's talk about the realities of out-of-state defendants who are no longer active participants in the case. And they're former employee retirees who have zero interest in seeing New Jersey, as much as we all love it, and are never going to respond to a notice in lieu of subpoena and can't be actually subpoenaed. If you're right, what each potential non-settling defendant then has to do is go through while in discovery and take that future discovery against each other defendant who may still be there. And maybe some people will go out on summary judgment, and maybe some defendants will be so minor that it's not worth doing. But the fact is that you're talking about an incredible complication of the burden of discovery, which takes money away from potential settlements.
I disagree that the attendance of the corporate representative can't be compelled at trial. The defendants served their notices in lieu of subpoena, and Williams v. Hodes, the appellate division case from 2003, held that the obligation to appear at trial survives dismissal. So they did have the ability to have those out-of-state corporate representatives come to trial. And when
we're talking about retirees who have historic knowledge, who may be in their 80s, this is very typical in this kind of litigation, you're saying that that person can be brought to New Jersey.
A person
may be brought, but that person who has the knowledge that you're talking about has to be established, can be brought to New Jersey after that settlement.
That corporation can be brought to New Jersey.
Understood. And so I'm talking about the actual people with knowledge of historic events.
Well, when they subpoena via a notice in lieu of subpoena and say the defendant didn't settle, they're going to bring the same person that they would have brought when they settle. So I think it's practical.
Am I wrong that many of these witnesses are fact witnesses? They're not the corporate designee. That the corporate designee is someone else?
No, these are all corporate designees.
Every single one. There were no fact witnesses as to what went on with the products, what products were used. There were not.
As counsel said, the only ones that were allowed in were the ones where the witness had been designated as a corporate. The prior depositions were when the witness was testifying as a corporate designee.
Are we cutting out people who are no longer in the employ of the corporation, such that the corporation is not able to command that person's presence?
Well, I think the issue is the availability of the corporation as opposed to the availability of any one individual. And the corporate designee can educate themselves and testify on those matters as designee.
So you're not arguing that the notice in lieu of subpoena requires the corporation to somehow haul before the court someone from out of state who is no longer in the employ of the corporation. You're not arguing that, are you?
No, it would be up to the corporation to choose who their corporate designee is. If it happens to be that person and they get them to come, that works. But it's not as if I expect them to send a personal subpoena.
If a corporate designee came in who had no personal knowledge of the events but educated himself by reading documents, would you object to that because the witness has no personal knowledge of any of the facts that witness is testifying to? Would there be an objection from you?
It would depend, again, on the scope of the testimony. If they're relying on documents and testifying to something that's in a document, not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
You'd be happy if they knew nothing. If they came in at the behest of a non-settling defendant and they said, I don't know, I'm just told I'm the corporate designee and I don't have any of the facts that you're looking for, you wouldn't be objecting, you'd be happy. You'd say that's a failure of proof.
Sure, but generally the corporate designees are educated on the years that the same types of facts that the defendants would want to get through the settled defendant evidence. They are educated on those basic details of the products, when they contained asbestos, which products contained asbestos, when they contained warnings.
Let's go back. Can I just go back to Justice Fernandez-Vina's question for a second?
Sure.
He said in his question,
don't misquote me.
Huh? I'm going to try not to. I thought it was pretty
I'm
good.
Right next to you.
I thought it was a pretty good question. I'm just going to try to echo it.
That's two of us.
He'll correct me if I'm mistaken.
We can't wait to hear this question.
But I, the reason why I'm asking again is because I'm not certain I heard an answer. So his question was, if the person who is retired, that person's testimony is now being picked up by the corporate representative, would you object? So I'm just going to add this to it, that what is going to be offered by the corporate representative through the retired is damning to your case. You're not going to object? I think you are, no?
Well, and again,
I like his question better.
It would certainly depend on the corporate representative's basis for the knowledge.
He's just getting it from the retiree, and now it's sinking your case. You're going to say hearsay, no?
Yeah.
It's possible that there would be hearsay objections to that evidence.
I thought
that's
so.
A consistent answer. I heard maybe before.
We're dealing with very skilled counsel, so the answer would be yes.
Going back to the 803C25, the statement against interest, hearsay objection, real quick, I just wanted to make one point that I didn't before we moved on. Really, I don't think this is the appropriate hearsay objection for the court to analyze this evidence on. One reason is because the lower court, the trial court, never exercised her discretion to admit it under those grounds. Another reason is because, as a matter of statutory construction, when you have specific rules that apply to depositions and interrogatories, those are the rules we should look at for this evidence rather than going to the more general rule for statements against interest, because we have specific rules that address when a prior deposition or a prior interrogatory response is available to be used despite its hearsay nature.
Can I ask a question? This is a general question. Could defendant's general approach, assuming you get just as much benefit from what they want to do, work to your advantage? I mean, since presumably the people you're suing are always attempting to minimize their responsibility in discovery and in their depositions, that would seem to be of help to you in the allocation, no?
Well, part of what happens with this evidence is, again, sometimes interrogatory responses aren't fully complete and don't contain the way a settled defendants would nuance that information if they were actually defending themselves at trial. Another problem, and it's touched upon in the NJAJ's brief, another problem with this evidence is that a lot of these are discovery depositions, and the people taking the discovery depositions did not have the same interest when taking that deposition to develop the testimony the way it would be presented at trial. So, for example, if you have a plaintiff who was taking this company's deposition, their interest at that time was to put as much liability on that defendant as possible.
Sure, that's the way the system's set up. It puts on both sides pressure to be the opposite of what they previously were. It puts on the defendant the defendant's counsel in the awkward position of saying, we're saying it's not enough to say no warnings and the product is there, is not liability. Now they're saying that it is liability as to everybody else while the jury's watching. It puts the plaintiff in a situation where what they were pursuing when they were after that defendant may actually turn back and hurt them. Everybody's got a difficulty with this process. Go ahead.
I think the difference here is that Universal was at the trial and able to present why just making asbestos product and not warning does not mean they should be liable. And by letting in this settled defendant evidence, we don't have them there to describe and explain why, even though they made the asbestos product and didn't warn.
Why don't you bring them in? If it's so easy to serve a notice in lieu of subpoena, and you're saying to us that there is nothing to it, you just serve that notice, and then those corporate designees come in, why not just do it?
Well, and I think that if this court overturns the appellate division, plaintiffs will strategize and find whatever ways we can to oppose the evidence, but it really sets up an inefficient system
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
Before the appellate division, hasn't this been the way this has been done in asbestos cases for decades? Just realistically?
Well, I certainly can't speak to the way
I know you're too young, but I mean, in the course of your experience.
As counsel said, this was the second trial with our current asbestos judge. I would say that the appellate division has disproved this practice. In an unreported decision in Butita, they actually said that this practice should not be carried out.
I understand, but hasn't this been the practice in asbestos cases for a long time? I'm not asking you to condone it or agree with it, but hasn't it been the practice for a long time?
It's certainly the practice. I can't speak to the trial judges prior to our current trial judge. My experience has been with her, but it's certainly the way that she reads the law. But I would say that even if this is a custom in practice, if it's against the rules of evidence, that doesn't mean it should stand. And a good example of that is the James v. Ruiz case, where the appellate division talked about that there had sort of become a custom of people relying on these out-of-court treating physicians' opinions and reports. And he said that Judge Sabatini, writing for the court, said that there had been a custom and that there's some confusion and some custom of allowing this. And despite that custom, he applied the rules of evidence and said, despite what people are doing, despite the efficiencies of maybe admitting this evidence, we still have to hold it to the rules of evidence.
Well, I just have one question. In terms of how you present your case in one of these cases, this is how I think you present your case, but you'll tell me if I'm mistaken. You basically put your client on, assuming your client's alive. You have an expert witness, correct? And then you start reading to the jury the defendant's interrogatories and depositions. Is that basically the way you present a case?
Personally, and what I've seen done is the calling of the corporate representative from the defendant. It's not always done that way. Sometimes it is done by prior proofs. But my preferred course and sort of what I've learned from some of the higher people who have been doing this for decades at my firm is to compel the defendant to bring their corporate representative in my case in chief, and then I might rely on the prior depositions or interrogatories to impeach them if they don't testify truthfully, but I would prefer the live witness. So as a practical matter, it sometimes is done that it's just interrogatories read in or prior depositions, but I think it's not uncommon to call the corporate representative from the trial defendant.
As long as we're at a half hour, is there a point that you wanted to make before you wrapped up?
Your Honor, the only...
If not, I think we understand your position.
If I can't find it that quickly, with that much time, it can't be that important.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Donahue.
May it please the court. I come here before the court on behalf of the New Jersey Association for Justice. The New Jersey Association for Justice feels that the appellate division did right by the rules of evidence and did right by the rules of court in finding that the trial court misapplied the law. The New Jersey Association for Justice feels very strongly that when the rules of evidence are applied and the rules of court are applied, especially in matters of apportionment, that we have fair results at trial as a result of trial. A fair administration of justice requires that we apply the rules of court and the rules of evidence in an equal manner, both to apportionment evidence that's presented by a defendant at trial or in a single party, single matter before a jury. No different rules should apply. This case comes before the court in a rather unique setting. It has uniqueness to it because of the fact that there are a number of settled defendants and a history of discovery. However, that uniqueness should not change the rules that we have stood by, that are well established, and that have been well applied for decades. Here we're talking about essentially three evidence rules. We're talking about the statement of a party opponent. We're talking about the use of prior testimony from prior matters and statements against interest. With respect to the statement of a party opponent.
Can I just ask one question generally?
Of course, Justice.
If that's so, that the settlement of the eight cases isn't going to be saving a whole lot of time. You're going to be trying basically eight had settled. This was the ninth defendant. We're back to nine trials with all the rules of evidence applying. At least every defendant may have a reason, financial reason for settling, but in terms of efficiency for trial purposes, we're going to be trying. You're still trying nine cases, no?
We're trying nine cases now. The jury is being asked to rule on the liability of nine defendants. There's no difference. The only difference here is the type of proofs that it's being submitted should be used are, to some, shortcuts.
Can you tell us in a sentence or three, because I think you were about to do it, why 803B1, 803C25, and 804A don't apply here?
803B1 doesn't apply because the declarant isn't present in court.
Okay.
We don't have the declarant there to defend the statement, and that's the whole basis for that rule.
That's why.
With respect to 804, the motives are far different. When I'm taking, or any lawyer in the state is taking a deposition, we are not there in the discovery setting to perpetuate trial testimony. And if this court rules that that needs to be the focus, it changes fundamentally what discovery is.
I know you're going to get to the third point, but are you saying that you have to have a debene esse deposition in order for 804 to apply? Because obviously discovery depositions are allowed before a debene esse, but discovery depositions are admitted every day.
I am not, Your Honor.
So what are you saying?
What I'm saying is that there needs to be proper application, focus, and attention to that part of the rule that requires that the motive needs to be the same or similar.
Let me just explore that. And I know you asked a question with three parts, and I've only allowed you to get to
third
two.
Part apparently is the only one that mattered.
Okay. All right.
I think.
Yeah. Are you saying that if your colleague over here, excellent lawyer representing a plaintiff, goes and takes a discovery deposition and is motivated to prove the liability of a particular defendant, then because that's a discovery deposition, they were not in the right, they weren't the right party to be taking that discovery?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
So what is it, what's the limitation?
Anyone who has been involved in what I would call serial cases, you know, whether it was 16-inch versus 16.5-inch multi-piece wheel cases, tread separation cases, we all work and learn from others who have taken depositions. But those depositions are not debene esses. Those depositions are not assumed to automatically be trial testimony. And to constrain, it's actually the opposite of what Your Honor asked me, to turn those into debene esses for all intents and purposes
would have a chilling
effect on discovery.
So you're saying that they're not admissible if they're not debene esses?
No, I'm saying that they're admissible when it's established that testimony that specifically is offered was generated by someone who had a motive the same or similar as the plaintiff under those circumstances.
Well, that's not
the
only
thing. Would it be admissible, counsel?
Let me get back to point three. That's not the only basis. There's another basis upon which it can be offered, and I think your adversary said 803C5 is really what we should be talking about. C25 is really what we should be talking about. So now, why is this not a statement under oath against the interests of the party against whom it is being offered? Why is it not a hearsay exception?
So far contrary.
Go ahead.
So far tending to subject. Not merely tending, not somewhat contrary. So far contrary. The rules are written.
What is the definition for so far?
Farther than far.
How far?
Okay.
What do I back to Princeton?
Your Honor, what it means is,
isn't
respectfully, what it says, and
is it
that it is more than merely contrary to to something that's contrary to the interests. It has to be clear on its face and absolute.
If the plaintiff's taking a deposition of a corporate defendant, is it the plaintiff's interest to show that they're negligent, they're liable in the case? If the co-defendant's attorney's taking that position after that, usually the same day, just one after the other, isn't that that attorney's interest too? So isn't that so far against their interest by virtue of the fact that they're skilled attorneys trying to hold a person in that it would be admissible?
Your Honor, respectfully, I think many lawyers have taken many depositions over the years to essentially model the expected direct, which is to look at the witness and ask questions of the witness based upon what they anticipate will be asked at trial so that they can hear what their trial testimony is. Some other lawyers may have a completely different mechanism and method and, quite frankly, motive of asking those questions. And so there's no one size fits all.
Is our rule of evidence going to be premised on the motive of the attorneys? Or maybe their lack of skill, some may ask better questions than others?
I think it would be unfair to saddle lawyers later in the case with questions that were asked by an unskilled, ill-prepared, or for one reason or another, not focused lawyer that were taken in another manner.
So that's the perfect solution from the plaintiff's perspective, because all the plaintiff would then have to come in and say is, if it were me taking the deposition, I would have done better. That's really what you're saying.
I don't think that's exactly what I'm saying, but if that was the answer, I would take it.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Can I bring you back to 803C25?
Absolutely.
Okay. Right. You have a party who was a defendant in an asbestos case, and you had that party under oath saying, we manufactured it, and we sold it and distributed it without warnings. Trial court hears that and says, that puts them halfway home on liability. I think that's a declaration against interest. They're not stupid.
When you add the jet fuel of telling the jurors that there was a
settlement. I'm a trial judge
way
now.
Far.
You know, I didn't tell the jury everything I was thinking. I'm making a ruling on evidence. You're halfway home. Why is that in the trial judge's view? Why doesn't that meet the standard of 803C25? We manufactured it, and we sold and distributed it without warnings. Okay, I think that's what your adversary was saying, that, hey, that's how it comes in.
Your Honor, these are questions that are asked through form discovery.
I understand. I get under oath. Somebody swore to it, said we manufactured it, we sold or distributed it without warnings. Why doesn't that come in?
And generally speaking, at trial, we don't try cases based upon the interrogatories and the depositions.
We have
trial testimony because we recognize that generally speaking, the interrogatories and many times the deposition answers tell part of the story. And you know, what we are offering here in this case is to put the balance, put the burden where the burden properly belongs.
So with that in mind, I want to ask you as a friend of the court to wrap up your argument and hopefully answer this for us. How should a case like this with a single remaining defendant and scores of other defendants at the start of the case proceed going forward?
I think the case can proceed going forward by calling the corporate representatives that are available. Many times parties settle cases for reasons that have to do with as much the responsibility as of the other party, as much as for the lack of responsibility. The important thing that needs to be before the jury is the best evidence, subject to cross-examination when appropriate, that we can put before the jury. We owe it to the jury. We owe it to the administration.
So take that. You have the corporate representative, but the corporate representative was not subject to the deposition. Someone who retired 10 years ago, who was deposed 20 years ago, has the historical facts. Tell me, how is the corporate rep supposed to work in that type of situation? You following me?
I am. I want to make sure that I get all the specific.
Yeah, I want to know what the corporate representative can testify to under those circumstances.
And bring it home with that.
Well, he can testify to what ultimately 414-2 allows him to testify to. So he's there to testify on behalf of the corporation.
Which is, what would 414 allow if he has no personal knowledge? What would 414 allow him to testify?
In the vast majority of situations, corporate representatives do not.
I understand that. That's why I asked you.
But that's the same burden that the plaintiff must face, and that's what the rules provide.
Yeah, but the plaintiff's not trying to use them. They're settled.
In Justice Ratner's offer,
I just want one more, and if I may.
Well, then
you don't have to answer
mine.
As a plaintiff's, I'm sorry. Did I?
No. Go ahead.
I'll come back to you.
No, it's okay. I won't be listening.
As a plaintiff,
I'm just kidding you.
As a plaintiff, you would not have to bring in a corporate representative. You could use the deposition of that representative, correct?
Once again, you know, I have personally, and I know many members of our organization have tried our cases by calling corporate representatives.
I understand it can be done, but
because it's
different question. You would not have to proceed that way. You could a plaintiff's counsel in an asbestos case could prove the case on paper.
Could attempt to prove the case.
So you're saying that on the allocation, they should be required to bring in corporate representatives when the plaintiff would not have to do that if it was their case in chief.
The difference is if I'm proving a case against a defendant, that defendant's in the courtroom to respond to it. That defendant's not in the courtroom to respond to it if it's done on the allocation
so
side.
So you're saying an evidentiary issue. I understand the balance is difficult for everybody. But as an evidentiary basis, you're saying that the non-settling defendant should not have the same right to proceed on paper as you would have as a plaintiff.
Your Honor, the right derives from the fact that the declarant is present in the courtroom.
Not necessarily. Your declarant the witness is not necessarily present in the courtroom. You read the deposition to the jury. You can read the deposition to the jury. Correct?
Against the defendant that's in the courtroom.
Right. The lawyers are in the courtroom, but that declarant's not there.
Well, that declarant, one, could be there if the corporation chooses, or somebody in an equal or superior capacity to address the testimony could certainly be there. But that's where the playing field's leveled.
But you are asking that a burden be put on the non-settling defendant that isn't to proceed with a witness or not proceed at all, that is not the same burden that's on you as a plaintiff.
I disagree with that because I believe that quite frankly, the defendant seeking apportionment has a lesser burden because they're able to under what is being offered here, being permitted to offer paper proofs against the defendant that's nowhere in the courtroom, leaving the plaintiff to try to do the very thing that they say that they can't do, bring the corporate defendant into the courtroom to defend it.
I think we have your position on that. Do you recall Justice Fernandez-Vina's question? If so, go ahead.
And I apologize if I interrupt.
No, apologies.
No.
One more shot, Your Honor.
I don't remember the question.
Do you remember his question?
No.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Brief rebuttal, Ms. Henry.
I'd like to go right to the so far contrary notion. I do some premises liability work, some casino work, some supermarket work. If the owner of the supermarket will admit at his deposition that there's a puddle of water in front of the refrigeration equipment and that the refrigeration equipment makes that puddle of water happen on any sort of regular basis, I am positive that plaintiff's counsel could get that in as a statement against interest, whether or not the supermarket manager says, and I know the plaintiff fell in it and I know the plaintiff broke his back in that puddle. So that's what we're doing here, but just on a much, much grander scale. Because the proofs we're talking about, I tried to look back at the record. I don't think any are from the 70s or the 80s because those defendants are no longer in the litigation for obvious reasons. So all these proofs are from the 90s and 2000s. In the 90s and 2000s, every company in the United States of America understood the scope of the asbestos litigation. They saw the number of cases, they saw the nationwide scope, and they've seen the verdicts and you've seen the verdicts. So I'm hard-pressed to find an admission that could be more against interest in our tort law system, and I'm sure we could all think of one, but it's a big one, to say that I sold products that contained asbestos and I sold them without warning, because it doesn't just affect you in that case, it affects you in
the case. I just want to, getting back to the what I think they were raising is, let's say the supermarket is on, they're a defendant in a case, a premises liability case, premised on the involvement of the trucking company that's bringing goods to their defendant. Separate company, bringing goods to the supermarket. They settle. They're no longer a party to the case. their deposition is now being offered by the plaintiff. How do you keep that out, or how do you keep that in?
I'm not sure I understand the
facts. An admission by that party in that case that somehow affects or puts the responsibility on the supermarket. How do you bring that deposition into the case?
So the trucking company's admission is implicating themselves, or the trucking company's admission is implicating the supermarket?
Either or both.
Well, if the trucking company's admission is implicating the supermarket, it's not a statement against interest, because it's got to be against the interest of the trucking company. So if the trucking company says, you know, the trolleys we use to push the product into the supermarket,
whatever,
let's grease get on the floor. I'm the supermarket defendant. I'm the last one at trial. Well, theoretically, plaintiff was probably at that dep, but let's say it was taken in another case. That's a statement against the trucking company's interest. It shows that they allow some condition to occur as a result of the work that they
and
do.
Your argument is that's the position that these contributing settled defendants have in your case, and that's why it comes in.
Absolutely. Okay. Only it's this much bigger because we have thousands of cases with us and the trucking company pending.
But either way, your argument is it comes in.
That's right.
Forget about the 80C25, the statement against interest. How does your proposal fit in with automobile negligence case and other non-asbestos cases where we have schemes of allocation and apportionment? Would you argue that this scheme should work in all such types of cases?
I don't know, frankly. So in an automobile negligence case, somebody is making a statement that has to do with their liability in that case, and they understand the against interest in that case.
They've settled. Forget about the statement against interest.
Okay.
You want it, because you're arguing it should come in an admission. So I'm trying to think through how this is going to work in all other types of cases.
If I can help, think of a three-car accident.
Yeah. So, you know, if car number two admits that it hits number one before three hits two, and car number two settles, I mean, that's an admission. That should be able to be read in regardless of whether that defendant remains at trial or is not at trial. I think it's the same analysis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll take the matter under advisement.